The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
So on to our next guest, Hugh Johnson, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer at Hugh Johnson Advisors. Hugh has more than 40 years of investment experience, and he has been with Hugh Johnson Advisors since its inception in 1994. As I said, Hugh, when I was talking to you about you at the top of the show, one of the wise heads of Wall Street, someone who has followed this for so long, to put this in perspective for us. Welcome.
Oh, thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
And I really appreciate it. In the note you put out in Japan this morning, you point out something that was discussed on our show yesterday, you say it's often the case that a financial or economic crisis occurs because it unfolds, it starts in a seemingly small, isolated, and insignificant part of the world and is dismissed as inconsequential, just as the Southeast Asia crisis started in 97, 98. Of course, Japan isn't small or inconsequential.
Right.
But this seems to me like an important, even though we could say global stock markets aren't down that much, nobody's been killed by a nuclear plant. Come on, everybody calm down. I agree with that. You still have this sense of wariness.
Oh, yes. Very much a sense of wariness. And wariness that this could grow in its intensity or have a bigger impact on not only the economy of Japan, because we're all obviously very worried about the impact on Japan, but that this could spread or could be transmitted around the world. In other words, what happens in Japan is certainly not inconsequential for Japan, but it's also not inconsequential for anybody around the world. Psychology, one. Obviously, everybody's scared when they see a decline in the stock market in Japan of the magnitude that we saw, but also commodity prices, trade, capital market movements, capital movements from Japan to other parts of the world, most notably the U.S. All of these things could be, for some time now, affected and not affected to the better.
Well, of course, you make me think. I always love to tell this story about being on the old Squawk Box with Mark Haynes back when the whole thing started. I came in to do my report that morning and mentioned that the Thai baht had been devalued. And Mark was, oh, why do I care about the Thai baht? Because you know what a great contrarian he is.
That's
we
right.
could buy all the Thai bots that exist in the world. And I just said, well, you know, that's how currency crisis starts sometimes. One little thing and the whole thing unravels, right?
Yes,
which was not me being prescient. It was just kind of like that's like a sort of like financial crisis 101.
That's exactly right. That's one of the basic lessons of financial and economic history, and that's really observant of you. And obviously, this started small, appeared inconsequential, but again, it spread through those normal transmission mechanisms. Psychology, as I mentioned before, the next thing that you knew is the Southeast Asia economy started to contract. Because the Southeast Asia economy started to contract, that means the demand for commodities, certainly from Southeast Asia, but around the world started to contract or was less. Commodity prices declined. That's certainly the decline in commodity prices hurt some of the countries in the world, Australia, Canada, Russia, I've mentioned, that depended so heavily on the export of those commodities to other parts of the world. And, of course, there was world trade and there was capital movements. So all of that, in other words, it appeared inconsequential initially, was transmitted to other parts of the world, particularly the commodity price component of it, where we saw a very sharp decline in the price of oil. And that very seriously impacted all of those countries that depended on oil for their well-being, most notably Russia. That, incidentally, in my judgment, led to the long-term capital management crisis that we saw.
Sure, because Russia, the banks defaulted on their bonds, and then the rest was sort of history. But again, an interesting comment from a listener, Hugh, as you and I are chatting here, that it's the shock that exposes structural flaws. It isn't necessarily the shock that causes the problem, but maybe those underlying flaws are there, and that's what becomes activated.
That's right. Well, it's not so much that they're flaws. I mean, we may look at them as flaws, but world trade is certainly not a flaw. Capital movements, well, there's certainly lots of things that could be done better when it comes to capital movements. I wouldn't call it so much a flaw.
We're speaking with Hugh Johnson, Chairman, Chief Investment Officer at Hugh Johnson Advisors. More than four decades of following markets, advising investors, managing money. Hugh, we're talking about Japan and how this event, which has caused so much damage to their economy, to their people, to their lives. There's the nuclear problem now as well, that as bad as it is for Japan, it's something that could be transmitted through our global markets and cause more problems outside of Japan. You talked about one transmission mechanism just being psychology. We've already seen some of that as stocks sell off following Japan sell off the last 2 days. You talk about commodity prices. When they fall, they hurt the big commodity sellers like Russia and oil. But I want to stop on that point for a minute, because that seems like one of the, at least in the near term, one of the small little silver linings in these terribly dark clouds, because the rising gasoline prices have been, somewhat of a threat to the U.S. consumer. At the very least, does that help offset some of the damage?
Well, to some extent it does. And obviously, it's to some extent good news for the U.S., even though we're very substantial producers of oil. But it might bring the price of oil down and bring prices at the pump down, and that's going to be good news for U.S. consumers. And always there's a trade-off somewhere. And the trade-off is that those countries, and I'm not talking just about the big oil producers in the Middle East, but other countries around the world that depend for their revenues on, or their export earnings on selling commodities generally or throughout the world. We mentioned Russia and oil, but also there are other commodities that are used by Japan, which will affect countries such as Australia and Canada, which I mentioned, which are very commodity-dependent countries. And so, there is to some extent a trade-off. To some extent, there is a silver lining. But at the same time that there's a silver lining, it's going to hurt some countries.
Okay, let's touch on your two other transmission mechanisms. One is easy for me to say, right? One is trade, the other is capital flows. Explain those to us.
Well, if the economy of Japan starts to contract, Japan becomes less of a factor in global trade, and it's not obviously inconsequential. It's not as small as Thailand. Japan is about 4.5% of global exports and imports. In other words, it's a very substantial player in international trade. So international trade will slow to some extent, and that's not good news for, let's call it, the global economy. So that's one thing. It's trade. The other thing that's very important is capital flows. Capital flows from Japan, particularly if their capital flows represented by their export earnings, but capital flows from Japan to markets around the world, like the U.S. market. For example, in the month of January, Japan accounted for 10% of the purchase of U.S. Long-term assets. International purchases of U.S. assets. That's pretty substantial. Japan and other countries like China are becoming big buyers of U.S. stocks and bonds, and obviously if that gets reduced, that affects our market some. So whether we're talking about trade flows starting to get hurt, or we're talking about a slowdown in the flow of money to the U.S. markets, either way, it will have some impact, not a major, hopefully, impact, but certainly some impact on the global economy, the global markets, and certainly the U.S. economy and the U.S. markets.
So having given us your four transmission mechanisms, pointed out that, you know, sometimes things start that don't seem they'll have a big impact around the world. This could. You still conclude that we are still in the upstage of a stock market economic interest rate cycle. Explain that, because it seems so ominous. There's so much caution and concern. How can you maintain that view?
Well, it is ominous, and it feels and looks ominous, but the question really is, if you try to quantify it, to what extent is this going to impact the global economy, and most importantly for all of us, the U.S. economy? Well, the U.S. economy is anticipated to grow roughly about 3.2% in 2011, 3.3% in 2012. So how much of will this shave off of those estimates of the outcome for the U.S. economy in 2011-2012. Well, if I take a little bit of oil in there, because oil is still a little bit higher, and I take the events in Japan, I think, and this is a sort of back of the envelope estimate that it might shave off maybe 0.5 to 0.8% off of U.S. growth in 2011, maybe a little bit less in 2012. So it doesn't mean that this cycle is over. It doesn't mean that this rising stock market, expanding economy, and now rising interest rate environment is over and behind us, that it's the start of a bear cycle. Not at all. It just means that it's likely to be interrupted or put on hold for the time being while we sort through the impact of this crisis.
You know, I'm getting a lot of references to black swans in reports and quotes from people. And one of the more interesting questions raised today in my email was, maybe these swans really aren't black? Have we kind of mispriced risk a bit and considered some of these events so impossible that have proven not to be from Egypt to Japan?
That's an excellent question. And the answer to the question, I think, has to do with the frequency with which black swans or exogenous or unexpected events occur. We've had so many recently. The Middle East, obviously, was just a bolt out of the blue. We didn't expect it. Now the events in Japan are a bolt out of the blue, unexpected. I still think they're black swans. They're unexpected events. They're not normal.
Okay. Hugh Johnson, thanks so much for joining us from Hugh Johnson Advisors. Up next, Frank Holmes on gold, oil, and more. Our next guest, Frank Holmes, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at U.S. Global Investors. Frank, welcome back. It's great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
So put this in perspective for us. Since the earthquake tsunami, the threat of a severe nuclear meltdown in Japan, commodity prices tumbling. Why?
I think that there's a substantial amount of groupthink. We saw some of this in 2008, where all the big banks and all the major hedge funds all have risk management teams, and they all have these VAR, value at risk, models, and they're quite similar. So as soon as the VIX triggers point A move and you have an increased volatility in certain commodities, immediately it triggers sell, 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 sell. So I would suspect that many portfolio managers are having their shoulders tapped upon to sell because they're all following this VAR, like groupthink, and they're all very similar mathematical models.
Okay, so then you don't buy the argument that if the world's third largest economy takes a hit and its demand for commodities suffer a bit, and if it does perhaps slow down, you know, have some ripple effects, that all of the things being equal, that would reduce demand for commodities somewhat and then be a logical reason for people to sell, particularly since some people said oil over $100 a barrel had a lot of speculation risk, a lot of fear priced into it.
Well, oil is interesting because it historically makes its low in February. And the lows start to rise quickly because of the North Africa contagion that was taking place, and in particular when it hit Egypt. So that threw it off. But oil was already forecast to trade higher prices throughout the year as the economic activity started to improve in America. So I think it's a normal seasonal pattern to rally from the lows of February until September. We will get a correction, and I think that we'll take a look at history of Japan. Commodities will go under a compression, and what's different when I like to compare, say, Japan to Haiti. One is it's very patriotic country. Two, very strong government organization skills. Complete departments know how to build infrastructure, and you'll see that replenished. And the family unit there is extremely cohesive. And with that, Japan in the previous troubles like this, the economic activity falls for that quarter and then has a massive rebound. This will be bigger than previous tragedies in their infrastructure rebuilding, and that will only put a greater demand on the commodity cycle, on this super cycle that's taking place. This is not going to stop China from building out. It's not going to stop India from building out, or Brazil and other places. So I think it's just a temporary correction that's in the place, and oil could fall to $85 a barrel and would probably position for a very attractive buying opportunity.
Okay, but if oil went up because Tunisia led to Egypt, led to Libya, and created this big question mark over the entire North Africa, Middle Eastern region about regimes, who could go next, et cetera. And if the concern has been, or the hope, whatever, the idea has been that if Saudi Arabia is steady and stable, we will not have a major threat to the energy market, but people have been somewhat, you know, there has been a question mark. Seems to me, again, referencing Bahrain, the other big story, the Saudis sending in troops. Saudis seem to be making it very clear that we should not expect anything like this as far as the leadership of that country is concerned to occur. And if so, if Saudi Arabia is stable, why should we have oil over $100 a barrel?
Because we're having starting to have a global economic turnaround. America is doing better. And demand is starting to pick up. So I think that that's a key factor to appreciate. And people will not become threatened until probably gas goes through $4.50 a gallon. We've seen spending, parking lots are full. The only real tragedy you see in this from higher fuel prices quickly is a rippling effect in airline prices. They've spiked dramatically, which has stopped flying, but people are driving.
Frank, you were just saying we want to look at Japan, and I want to get back to this question of demand more broadly. But just before the break, we were talking about Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and I believe you were making the point that the fact the Saudis have gone into Bahrain to quell the demonstrations there, were you saying that's a step taken so the United States doesn't have to? I mean, it's not as though we haven't even done anything in Libya. Why would anybody think we'd go into Bahrain?
Just like we went into Kuwait to protect interests, if there's such a difficulty. And I think that also in it, so the global scene is that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, top advisor, will likely be visiting the U.S. this week. And I think that it's really important to see what's taking place with Saudi Arabia. They're basically playing a Saudi-led offense presents a strategic roadblock to Iran. And Iran would like to see difficulties there because it distracts from their own domestic issues. And higher oil prices help them with their foreign exchange.
Sure.
And so one has to not just appreciate that there's lots of politics here mm-hmm. that are driving this equation. And I think that what the Saudis have done is very strategic and important. But on the sell-off of coming back earlier to all these stocks and commodities sort of unilaterally across the board, what's important is what I mentioned earlier is that all these risk managers and all these major banks and hedge funds and asset management companies have a value at risk model, and they all trigger selling, and they sell everything across the board to raise liquidity, especially when you have the red alert coming out of rising radiation heading south of Japan with two more explosions occurred at the Fukushima Daiichi mm-hmm. nuclear power plant. Let's get through this the next 6 weeks. What does it mean the next quarter? It likely means that there's going to be big demand for oil from Japan because the nuclear reactors are not going to be working. And so you go through this lull, this correction in oil as it goes to this jittery place in the global scene. But most likely we see natural gas prices firming up, and I think you could probably see you've seen coal and oil. So the world will shift as Japan has to rebuild over the next 2 years, and the demand for these other commodities will take place, and maybe QE2 has to stay in place.
Well, one step at a
time. Or QE1 to QE2.
Yes, yes. Frank, now I know you have direct investments in various parts of the world, including the oil market in Colombia, for example. What is your so you are long oil in a very real sense? Is that correct?
Yeah, in fact, we were just talking about this morning. In February, oil was up on we have our own sort of quant models, and it's very different what the banks use. And they were up 2 standard deviations for us, and we sold 20% of our positions.
Okay, so you took some money off the table, but you're still long oil? You're still an oil bull?
Yeah. I think that oil could easily correct to $85 a barrel on a sort of a liquidation panic. And I think you got to load up on it.
How high is it going to go? What's your forecast for 3 months, 6 months, 2 years?
I think over the next couple of years, you're going to see it back to the 140 level.
Wow.
And And it's just going to be a gradual process with economic activity growing around the world and adjustments. And we'll start to slowly see that show up as inflation as it permeates through commodity prices for the manufacturing of other products. But I don't think you're going to get a spike like we had 2008, a quick spike, which is difficult. I think you're just going to slowly see it increase. Like I think the price of gold over the next 5 years is going to double, and it'll grow at a 50% compounded rate of return for the fact that the emerging countries have money supply growing over 15%, and they have an emotional attachment to buying gold. I call the love trade along with the fear trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Love and fear. What's more powerful than that? And gold, of course, trading today at $1,392 an ounce. It's down almost $33. So certainly it, too, is, I guess you could say it's subject to this value at risk, take some risk off the table. But you just said double. Okay, let's do the math. $1,400. So you say gold's going to $2,800 an ounce over the next 2 years?
For the next 5 years.
Five years,
yeah. I think, you know, the oil prices and could double, and I think that gold can double over the next 5 years based on what is a super cycle in commodities. And they last about 20 years. We're halfway through it. And the world's population has doubled from the 70s. China and India had no global footprint in the 70s, and Russia was behind the Iron Curtain. Today, those three economies are rebuilding with free markets, infrastructure throughout their economies. In 1973 is when the EPA was formed. So today, the environmental cost, which is so important for clean water and clean air, has driven up the barriers to entry and the cost for exploring and developing any of these resources. So it is, the population of the world's doubled. Two, Chindia is now 15% of global GDP and 15% of the consumption of the world's oil, but they're only 40% of the world's population, but they're growing at 9% a year. I mean, these are just long-term structural issues that we have to deal with. And the world supply of oil has not doubled in the production relative to the world's population. And I think that these are important long-term, and within it, you're going to get tremendous volatility in that process.
Okay, I want to ask you to run through really quickly. We've got about a minute and a half left. How people should invest, even less than a minute, maybe 45 seconds. ETFs, gold coins, do I buy energy companies? How do I make money on this?
Well, first of all, you buy gold for the one you love. And so if you buy a gold stock or an ETF and it goes down, you're not going to get in trouble. That's a joke.
Okay, now quick, people want to know what Frank Holmes says they should buy. How do they ride this wave?
I think you got to go with active money management. You have to go with people that are seasoned professional. And, you know, the ETFs can provide a vehicle for getting in and getting out. But we've shown over time to be able to outperform these equity ETFs in this space.
Okay.
So to do this volatility, rotation around the world, one has to have this sort of flexibility.
Quickly, in 10 seconds, would you buy coins?
Yes, buy. Just be careful of the markup you're paying. And today's a great day. You can buy $33 off the spot price and the premium.
Okay. Frank, you're going to have to come back soon.
Take care.
Thanks so much to Frank Holmes, CEO, Chief Investment Officer at U.S. Global Investors.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keene and listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on satellite radio, Sirius Channel 130 and XM Channel 129. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.